From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The World Health Organization held a briefing for the media on Monday on the COVID-19 virus, and we bring you as much of that as time will allow.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our regular press briefing on COVID-19. Today is June 22nd, and with us we have Dr. Tedros, WHO Director General, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, and Dr. Mike Ryan. Before I give the floor to Dr. Tedros for his opening remarks, I would just like to remind journalists who are watching us on Zoom that you can listen this briefing in 61 languages, that's English, French, Spanish, Arabic, Russian, Chinese, but also in Portuguese and Hindi if you look on your tab under settings. And that's possible thanks to our interpreters who are here with us today. You can also ask questions when we get to that in all those languages except Hindi. I'll give the floor now to Dr. Tedros for his opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Tariq. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. It seems that almost every day we reach a new and grim record. Yesterday, more than 183,000 new cases of COVID were reported to WHO, easily the most in a single day so far. More than 8.8 million cases have now been reported to WHO, and more than 465,000 people have lost their lives. Some countries are continuing to see a rapid increase in cases and deaths. Some countries that have successfully suppressed transmission are now seeing an upswing in cases as they reopen their societies and economies. All countries are facing a delicate balance between protecting their people while minimizing the social and economic damage. It's not a choice between lives and livelihoods. Countries can do both. We urge countries to be careful and creative in finding solutions that people stay safe while getting on with their lives. We continue to urge all countries to double down on the fundamental public health measures that we know work. Finding and testing suspected cases works. Isolating and caring for the sick works. Tracing and quarantining contacts works. And protecting health workers works. At the same time, these measures can only be effective if each and every individual takes the measures that we also know work to protect themselves and others. Maintain physical distance, continue cleaning your hands, and wear a mask where appropriate. Just as we do the things that we know work to prevent the spread of the disease, we're also learning more about how to treat the sick. Although the data is still preliminary, the recent finding that the steroid dexamethasone has life-saving potential for critically ill COVID-19 patients gave us a much-needed reason to celebrate. The next challenge is to increase production and rapidly and equitably distribute dexamethasone worldwide, focusing on where it's needed most. Demand has already surged following the UK trial results showing dexamethasone's clear benefit. Fortunately, this is an inexpensive medicine, and there are many dexamethasone manufacturers worldwide who we're confident can accelerate production. Guided by solidarity, countries must work together to ensure supplies are prioritized for countries where there are large numbers of critically ill patients and that supplies remain available to treat other diseases for which it is needed. Transparency and constant monitoring will be key to ensuring needs dictate supplies rather than means. It's also important to check that suppliers can guarantee quality as there is a high risk of substandard or falsified products entering the market. WHO emphasizes that dexamethasone should only be used for patients with severe or critical disease under close clinical supervision. There is no evidence this drug works for patients with mild disease or as a preventative measure, and it could cause harm. WHO is also continuing to support countries with essential supplies of personal protective equipment and laboratory diagnostics. One way we're doing that is through the COVID-19 supply portal, an online platform through which countries that need supplies can enter requests. So far, 48 countries have made requests for supplies with a value of $92 million. WHO is currently in the process of shipping more than 140 million items of personal protective equipment to 135 countries, 14,000 oxygen concentrators, and millions of tests. Meanwhile, WHO is also working with countries to maintain essential health services. WHO recently surveyed countries to assess the impact of the pandemic on essential health services. Of the 82 countries that have responded so far, more than half have limited or suspended at least one service delivery platform, such as outpatient or inpatient services or community-based care. Almost three quarters of countries reported that dental and rehabilitation services have been partially or completely disrupted. Around two-thirds of countries reported disruptions to routine immunization, diagnosis, and treatment for non-communicable diseases and family planning and contraception. More than half of countries reported disruptions for mental health disorders, antenatal care, cancer diagnosis and treatment, and services for sick children. Countries are using a variety of strategies to deal with these disruptions, including triage, telemedicine, and redirecting patients to alternative health facilities. Still, the consequences of these disruptions will be felt for many years to come. The world is learning the hard way that health is not a luxury item. It's the cornerstone of security, stability, and prosperity. That's why it's essential that countries not only respond urgently to the pandemic, but also that they invest in strong health systems domestically and in global health security. Last year, world leaders came together at the United Nations General Assembly in New York to adopt a landmark political declaration on universal health coverage. Now more than ever, all countries must make universal health coverage a priority. It's not a question of whether countries can afford to do this. It's a question of whether they can afford not to. I thank you.
Many thanks, Dr. Tedros, for these opening remarks. We will now open the floor to questions, and we will try to have one question per journalist. So we will start with Sputnik, and we have Valentina online.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question. Do you hear me?
We hear you very well.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask WHO's position on an announcement made by the South Korean authorities that the country is experiencing now a second wave of the novel coronavirus infections in Seoul. Are there indeed indications of a second wave rather than a second peak within the first wave there? And should other countries, which were like South Korea, among those hit by the pandemic first, anticipate a second wave as well anytime soon? Thank you very much.
So thank you for the question. I can start. There are many countries right now that which have had success in suppressing transmission and bringing human-to-human transmission down to a low level that are starting to see increase in cases. And there's a number of reasons for that. They've either seen outbreaks in certain settings or closed settings like we've seen related to either religious events or related to outbreaks in dormitories of expatriate workers or in different types of facilities. Whether that's a second wave, you've heard us speak about this before, where any opportunity that the virus has to take hold, it will. And it's really important that countries are in a position to be able to rapidly detect these cases cases and put everything they can to isolate cases so that the outbreaks don't become larger and that these small numbers of cases don't become clusters and that these clusters of cases don't become community transmission again. Korea has a lot of experience in dealing with COVID, like all countries do now, and in particular when they see outbreaks that are occurring in specific settings and they know what to do. So we urge all countries to be at the ready to be able to detect any cases that pop up, regardless of where they may be. We know that there are particular vulnerable settings, primarily where there may be patients, so in healthcare facilities, whether you have closed settings where people are in close contact with one another, and be really ready to find those cases, isolate cases, carry out comprehensive contact tracing, and care for those individuals who need care in medical facilities.
And if I can supplement, certainly I'm not aware of an announcement by the Korean authorities on the subject that you mentioned, but I can note that there's only been a 3% overall increase in cases in Korea in the last week, and in fact I think only three deaths reported in the last week. But what is clear is there have been new clusters in multiple settings in Seoul. The overall number of cases actually in South Korea is very, very stable, or actually dropping. These new clusters, obviously, they're linked to various settings, to clubs, to shelters, to amusement parks, and to particular settings in which transmission has been diagnosed. My understanding is that the vast majority of cases being detected are linked to existing and recognized clusters, and as such the South Korean authorities still have great visibility over where the virus is and the dynamics and the chains within which the virus is transmitting. But that's a constant struggle to stay ahead of the virus. So continued vigilance is extremely important. I know the Korea Center for Disease Control and the government and the Republic of Korea are hugely skilled now in detecting clusters and investigating clusters and in doing the kind of targeted measures that allow them to bring these clusters under control. But it is a challenge for all countries, and I think South Korea with other countries demonstrate that even when you get down to very low incidence, you still have to have a very strong public health surveillance system, and you still have to have a very capable public health infrastructure. You still have to have a population that is willing to take the necessary actions. And I think what we see in the Republic of Korea is a highly engaged community that believes in science, believes in its authorities, and is willing to implement measures at a subnational level that are aimed at reducing transmission. So from that perspective, I would say that Korea is still on track with its disease control efforts. But like all countries, there are always risks of any disease getting out of control.
Many thanks. Next question comes from Juan Miguel Hernandez from El País. Juan, can you please unmute yourself?
Hello. Hola. ¿Me oye?
Hello, can you hear me? I wanted to ask, with regard to reports in recent days of people in Spain who have said they have persistent symptoms of coronavirus, cough, fever, respiratory difficulties, and this over the last 3 months. What's the research ongoing or the WHO's perception with regard to that? Thank you.
Thank you for this question. Yes, we're working through our clinical network and with clinicians who are dealing with patients infected with COVID-19 to understand not only how the patients are dealing with disease and what kind of disease they experience while in hospital, but after they recover and when they are released from hospital and they go home. We have guidelines around rehabilitation and follow-up of those who do recover. And we should say that we are seeing millions of people who are recovering from COVID-19, which is a very good sign. But indeed, there are people who have persistent, some people who have persistent symptoms, like a long-term cough, like a dry cough for some time. They may feel quite fatigued for some time. It may feel some shortness of breath while they're climbing stairs. But we are working to better understand what recovery looks like, and more specifically and more importantly, what type of long-term care, if needed, what does that look like for people who have recovered? We do know people who have more severe infection, who've perhaps been intubated, may have some damage to their lungs, and that may take a longer time to recover. But again, we're still learning about this disease. We're still learning about how people recover and what care they need after they are discharged from hospital.
Thank you. Next question coming from AFP, Nina Larson. Hello, Nina.
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Very well.
Okay, thank you for taking my question. I wanted to ask, following the release of data from a National Health Institute study of wastewater in Italy last week, suggesting that the novel coronavirus was present in two large Italian cities in December. I was wondering if WHO is still confident that the virus source is in China, or if you're, and also if you're aware of other wastewater studies showing similar results that might raise questions about the understanding of when and where this pandemic actually began. Thank you.
And this is the Italian findings are, I think, are very interesting. I don't believe that the live virus was cultured, but I do believe it was related to RNA fragments. And it is always important that if RNA fragments are recovered from water that was collected in December, then clearly there is a chance that this virus was circulating in northern Italy, obviously before anyone had realized that it had been. Having said that, the documented importation of cases, which temporarily, from a timing point of view, led to the explosion of cases, what's not clear is to what extent the presence of the virus or the potential presence of the virus in the environment before the known importation, in what way did that contribute to the amplification of disease at community level? So it's very important that these results are further pursued. I know there have been other wastewater or water-based studies. Maria may give you more details on those studies. But it is important. These are important findings, and it's very important that they're pursued. I don't think at this point it changes the hypothesis on disease origin per se, but we must remain open to any scientific findings that offer us clues as to the potential emergence and amplification of this disease in human populations. Maria?
Yeah, only to very briefly add that the use of looking for the virus in wastewater, and as Mike has pointed out, this is looking for fragments of the virus, so RNA fragments of the virus, not live virus has not been isolated from wastewater. What we're looking at is in the context of surveillance for COVID-19, we know primarily we need to focus on looking for people who are infected with the virus, actively infected with the virus, because this is important for making sure that they have the right clinical care and that we follow their context, and so we could break chains of transmission. But in addition to that, we're looking at other ways, potential ways in which we can look to see if the virus is circulating. We've mentioned looking at the influenza-like illness and the severe acute respiratory illness, respiratory disease surveillance that exists in most countries to see if it's circulating in the community. Wastewater is another potential way in which we can look to see if the virus may be there. But again, that won't help you find individuals who are infected with this virus, which is so critical at looking at suppressing transmission, so finding those individuals. So that is something that is in our overall surveillance portfolio for COVID. And we hope that this will be helpful in determining where the virus may be present, where it may be more difficult to find individual patients. But it is critical that our surveillance efforts, the most of our surveillance efforts, are focusing on finding individuals who are actively infected with COVID.
Thanks. Next question. N1 TV from Bosnia Herzegovina. We have Esmir online. Esmir?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is regarding region of the Western Balkans. Are you afraid that we are going to have increased the number of cases? Because yesterday in Croatia, we have a tennis tournament in Zadar with quite few players and officials infected with COVID-19. Also in Serbia, yesterday we had parliamentary elections with almost 3.5 million people voting. Bosnia has a number of cases reporting over the last 24 hours increased. And also in Montenegro, we have religious processions. And in all those cases, we haven't seen many masks and protections. Are we on the road to have more and more cases reported? Thank you.
From the perspective of the Western Balkans and also countries further to the south, certainly they have been in the main less affected than other countries in the European region early on in the epidemic. And some have been very successful in ensuring that the disease numbers have been kept low. But as we've said, in other countries in Asia, they've managed to get their numbers very low, and in countries that still have low numbers, there is always the chance of disease amplification, particularly in association with mass gatherings. We've seen that in some of the outbreaks in Europe and in other places, where amplification events can occur, super spreading events can occur, and disease can explode very quickly. We've seen super spreading events in any number of different settings, mainly in closed indoor settings, both occupational, residential, and other settings. So there are always risks, and it's really important that the gains that have been made by countries in the Balkans that have avoided the worst of this disease, that they continue to sustain those efforts. And it is very important that the same measures are applied, that people are aware and are applying hygiene measures, that physical distance is being respected, even in the situations of low incidence, that people are wearing masks in the appropriate settings, and that organisers of mass gatherings are aware and managing the risks associated with those gatherings. All countries have specific recommendations related to the gatherings, the size of gatherings that can occur, and how those should occur and how risks should be managed. I can't specify for any individual country what those are. But organisers of gatherings, whatever those gatherings may be, should respect the advice of national authorities and try as best as possible to implement those. The measures that are being advised are very simple, they're very practical, and it's incumbent on all to apply them. And we do hope that the countries in the area that have had a great deal of success in keeping the numbers low will continue to do so if those measures are applied in a systematic way.
Next question is for Sarah Newey from Telegraph. Sarah?
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes.
Brilliant. There's been reports that today that Africa is nearing 300,000 cases. I just wondered, I mean, how much do you think that's an underestimate? And do you think that Africa could be the next hotspot? We've seen it. It's obviously focused in Latin America and North America at the moment, but are you concerned that that might shift in the coming months?
I think the situation in Africa is mixed, and I think Africa is a very large continent, both in the sub-Saharan sense and North Africa, which are in two different WHO regions. But you know, we've seen increases of disease in some countries in excess of 50% in the last week, and we've seen other countries with very, very stable numbers. But in general, the numbers are on the rise. In Africa, we've seen large increases in places like South Africa. We've seen increases in places like Benin, in Eritrea, in Ethiopia, in Burundi. What we haven't seen yet are large increases in the number of deaths. So Africa at this point is still avoiding the large proportion of deaths that have been associated with this disease in other continents. Now there are issues, there are important caveats here. Testing is not as frequent in Africa, so there clearly could be underreporting of cases. Hospitals do not appear in most countries to be overwhelmed, but in certain countries, like in Nigeria and in heavily populated areas like Lagos, hospitals have come under significant pressure. So I would say the situation in Africa in general is very mixed. It very much depends on the context in which people are living. Larger cities seem to be more affected. We've seen outbreaks in refugee camps. We've seen as I said, increases in cases in a number of different settings. Will Africa be the next epicenter for this pandemic? I certainly hope not, because the health systems in Africa in general are weaker than in other parts of the world. Populations, while they have the benefit of an age profile that's much younger, there are many people with underlying conditions. There are many, many vulnerable people. And we need to try and keep these numbers as low as possible, while at the same time making sure that the lives and livelihoods are protected. And this is a constant challenge. So there is no room for complacency on the African continent. This is a time to really focus in on improving surveillance, really focus in on improving the capacity of healthcare to treat cases, and to focus in on some of those countries that are experiencing quite large increases of cases. And our African Regional Office, our Eastern Mediterranean Office, continue to work with those countries. And we have WHO offices in all of the countries in Africa, and will continue to work closely with governments there, both to suppress transmission and to reduce case fatality where that is a problem.
We will have now China Daily. We have Chen with us.
Hello. Hi. I just have a question. Forgive me if you have already published such a guideline. You know, countries who have actually reopened lately, I mean, like Europe or, you know, some other places, people started traveling. So has WHO published the guidelines on travel industry? I mean, how, like, whether car rentals or hotels could be safe? I mean, wouldn't it become a super spread? Thank you.
I can start, and maybe Mike would like to supplement. Yes, I mean, we are working very closely with the travel and tourism industry to support them in the process of opening up and the process of having travel that's safe, and making sure that we reduce the risk of transmission within facilities related to travel. So we do have a series of documents out on guidance around hotels. We're working with the airline industry to look at the safe resumption of flights, and we will have more guidance coming out in the coming days on this to be able to support the safe reopening. But it is important that while people travel through the whole process of travel, you know, leaving their home to where they reach their destination, that is done in a safe manner. And not only is it important for the industry and the airlines and the hotels to be able to offer safe experiences, we need individuals to also play their role. And for example, the DG highlighted this in his speech today. It's important that everyone at an individual level know what they can do to protect themselves, to protect their families, to protect their communities from infection and from onward transmission. And this includes the basics. It includes all of the basics of physical distancing of at least 1 meter, making sure you practice respiratory etiquette, that you wear a mask when you need to wear a mask in situations where you can't do physical distancing and where there's transmission, making sure that you practice hand hygiene. All of these things need to be practiced globally as we move forward, as this pandemic evolves.
And as Maria said, we will be issuing further guidance in the coming days as countries open up to travel between each other. But again, I think it's important to emphasize that it's the responsibility and duty of each sovereign state to put in place the protections for its own population, and that applies not only within countries but with regard to travel into and out of any given country.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.